Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
The local perspectives, breaking news, and trusted journalism you hear on NPR News are all powered by member support. Donate now during the spring member drive to keep this vital service accessible to all at nprnews.org. This is NPR News, and I'm Angela Davis. So glad to have you join us today. A quick reminder that it is our spring member drive here at NPR. Your gift today strengthens NPR for everyone and creates a more connected Minnesota. We need you to support this vital work with your monthly sustaining gift by going to nprnews.org or calling 800-227-2811. Members power everything that we do here, especially when it comes to shaping our coverage to reflect and serve all Minnesotans. With your support, NPR is a place where Minnesotans can come to better understand each other and the issues that matter to you and your neighbors. So keep the conversations going. Become a sustaining member now at nprnews.org or by calling us at 800-227-2811. Now, NPR News is in the middle of a very ambitious reporting project called North Star Journey. It focuses on the history and the culture of Minnesota's diverse communities. Now, since the project launched in March, reporters have produced a wide range of in-depth stories. Some look back at the little-known history here. Now, for instance, did you know Edina was originally an interracial farming village where African Americans and whites lived together, not only just living adjacent to one another, but actually integrated? Other stories explore how communities today are finding solutions to problems that disproportionately impact communities of color. Our reporters have done stories about boosting Somali home ownership in St. Cloud, about Worthington's fast-growing communities of color, and schools in Duluth trying to bridge the city's long east-west divide. Today, I am excited to talk with two NPR News editors about the series of reports we call North Star Journey. What led to it, and what are some of the highlights, and what's coming up next? Let me introduce my guests and my colleagues in the studio today. We have Sarah Glover, the managing editor of NPR News. She leads our team of reporters and editors. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Angela, for having me this morning.
Good to see your smile. And we also have Brant Williams here. Now, Brant is an NPR News editor overseeing the Race, Class, and Communities team. And prior to becoming an editor last year, he spent more than 20 years working as a reporter covering the city of Minneapolis for NPR News. Hi, Brant.
Morning, Angela.
Hi. So, Sarah, I'll begin with you. What is North Star Journey? What is the best way to describe this?
It is an amazing reporting project by NPR News. We are focusing on telling the rich stories of communities across Minnesota. And it's through these storytelling narratives are through a historical or a cultural lens. And this is a focused effort over 5 months. We started in March and will publish through July. But the response has been incredible. And clearly our audience and listeners are excited about this content. So we hope it will go on and on and on and will be integrated into our workflows. But to dig a little deeper on like really what it is and how it all started, I'd like to just coin a term and introduce it. Maybe I'll write about it on the website and okay. Write an editor's note to explain it a little further. But I really think in the root of it all is, it's really what we're doing here is culturally responsive journalism. And what that means is, as a news organization, NPR News is responding to communities, and we're focusing on information gaps and really trying to serve the communities that we cover. And so we're responding to community needs. And right now, more than ever, we need to hear from communities. We need to celebrate the champions and the leaders within communities that we cover and really shift our narrative focus to enterprise journalism. And I think that's what Brant and our team here is putting, leaning into and putting all the effort toward elevating distinct voices.
Now, Sarah, I know that North Star Journey, it was very much informed by listening sessions with community members. And so who did you talk to and what did you hear from people in those sessions?
You know, we have a phenomenal department. Our community engagement department and our audience insights team really puts a lot of effort in cross-pollinating our work from not just doing journalism, but as an organization, really listening to our communities. And so they really spearheaded that. But we work together on a community, a diverse community surveys with the APM Research Lab as a newsroom. And out of that, we learned not only about the trends across Minnesota, but we really listened to diverse perspectives across the state of Minnesota. And we came out of that knowing and recognizing that we need to do more work. We need to really embed our focus and our stories in all communities across Minnesota. And where we saw that dearth of coverage was around diverse communities. So this project kind of kicks off that effort.
And Brant, I know there was an internal pitching process. There were a lot of emails that went out to the staff.
Yeah.
Reporters, producers, hosts, other newsroom staff submitted more than 100 ideas for stories and shows. So tell me, what were you looking for?
So what we were really looking for is to rely on our reporters' background and their expertise and their jobs to find stories that may not be as widely known or stories that look at an event or a part of Minnesota history through the eyes of folks who experienced it in ways that we don't normally report on or normally that you see in other larger news organizations. So we wanted to present stories that also connect past to what happened in the past, what's going on today. For instance, I mean, we do cover a lot of stories about present day disparities, racial disparities in many different forms. And this is a way to kind of go back and look at some of these, where these came from, what were some of the things that influenced what we see today. And so reporters and other producers and others got a chance to draw on their own experiences, their interests. We have a lot of folks who are kind of like history nerds here, including myself. So it's really, you get a chance to start kind of go down little rabbit holes. Of, it's like, oh, so that's what this was connected to. And so that's what we, our reporters and our producers and everybody were able to like satisfy those curiosities and use some of their knowledge of their beats that the stories they normally cover.
I think, you know, I always say I'm a news consumer as well. What I've gotten from many of these reports is the, but why? Like, we know that there is this division or there's this difference, but why? So we're going to take a moment here to listen to part of a story that aired as part of the North Star Journey series. It's from Duluth. It's about the divide between the city's more working class and racially diverse west side and the whiter and more prosperous east side of town, and how these divisions come clearly into focus at the city's two high schools. Here's reporter Dan Crocker.
In a hallway in Denfeld High School's second-floor science wing, Principal Tom Tuscan steps up to his laptop, perched on a tiny wheeled cart.
Welcome to my office.
For the past few months, this is where Tuscan has responded to emails, participated in Zoom calls, and greeted students.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Tuscan says a lot of students struggled when they returned to school after a year of remote learning. So he and several other school officials moved their offices to the hallways. He says it's helped discourage students from skipping class.
Every time we've done something like this and we have pulled back, we have lost ground. So the idea behind this is we'll be out here as long as it takes to create the culture change that needs to happen.
Tuscan says this is just one example of the additional interventions many students need at Denfeld, a diverse school on the city's west side. Nearly half of students qualify for free and reduced lunches. About a quarter receive specialized education services. Tuscan says many face trauma at home stemming from mental health and other challenges.
It always feels like we're walking uphill. Nothing ever comes easy. People never see us walking uphill with our kids. They don't see people walking uphill with these kids every single day. But then you're going to throw judgment down on us for not having a graduation rate where it needs to be or having MCA scores where they need to be.
Tuscan says often all people look at is how Denfeld compares to East High School, the city's other public high school on the wealthier side of town. And those disparities are substantial, despite long-standing efforts to close the gaps. Ebony Hillman, Education Committee co-chair of the local NAACP chapter, says recent test scores showed nearly three-quarters of East students were proficient in reading compared to fewer than half of Denfeld students.
Just that shows you the difference in the education that our students are getting from the west side of town in comparison to the east side of town.
Duluth's east-west divide has roots in the city's industrial boom in the late 1800s, when lumber mills and factories sprouted up along the St. Louis River west of downtown. Those jobs lured poor immigrant laborers. Duluth historian Tony Durkin says wealthier residents migrated east, in part to escape the thick smoke that coal generators belched in West Duluth.
So you get this wealthy residential eastern end of town, and the poor blue-collar industrial, lower-income folks on the west part of town.
Racial segregation took root in the early 1900s. U.S. Steel recruited African Americans to work at its mill in western Duluth, but didn't let them live in the neighborhood the company built for workers. That segregation was further cemented in the 1930s, when the government evaluated the perceived lending risk in different parts of town.
They looked at neighborhoods through a very racist perspective.
Kathy Wilson is a Duluth city planner who's researched the history of redlining in Duluth.
Mostly it was neighborhoods with black people and newer immigrants that were evaluated as too risky to invest in solely because of the people who lived there.
As a result, those neighborhoods were neglected for decades. Wilson says today poverty is still concentrated in those western neighborhoods. So are the city's Black and Native American populations.
It's like they froze. They took a snapshot of the neighborhoods in Duluth in 1936 and said, we're going to keep it like this.
You're just listening to an excerpt of a report by Dan Crocker looking at the divide that we're seeing in Duluth today. But the history of it, or as I said earlier, the but why, an example of the North Star Journey, a series of reports that we have launched here at NPR. I'm talking with our managing editor, Sarah Glover. Sarah, you asked reporters to be creative and think big for these series. And did you see that happen in this report about Duluth?
Yes. Dan Crocker unpacked something that struck a chord. This story is actually one of the most viewed pieces on our website. And really, it's a water cooler moment that Dan was able to bring members of the community together to have this conversation. And interestingly so, because it's been so impactful, we're going to go to Duluth, hopefully in the month of June, in person, and host an in-real-life event to continue this conversation. Because really, with this work and why it's so powerful is that we're able to bring communities together.
Yeah, let's understand the history of and the culture of our state and talk about it. Sarah, I know that there is a podcast in development, or is it already out there, a North Star Journey podcast that's going to make it really easy for people to hear all of these stories.
Yes, the beautiful thing is each and every story thus far is available on our site and on podcast platforms. And it's really a carousel of all of the work. But secondarily, we are creating a signature podcast. And Brant Williams is one of the hosts. And this is going to be very special. And the title of that podcast is Untangled Roots, and it launches May 31st, 2022. So you'll have to pay close attention. It's going to be pretty impressive and powerful.
Brant, you self-identified as a history nerd.
Bet.
What is it like for you? I mean, we do lots of reporting here at NPR, but personally, what does it mean for you to have an opportunity and extra time to work on stories like this and see your colleagues really dig deep into the history of Minnesota?
Well, it's great to be able to do because it's such a broad range that we can cover, right? I mean, looking at the history and culture of Minnesota communities, so that gives us license to reach out to, you know, northern Minnesota, different regions that many of us, for me, as somebody who likes to go visit different parts of the state,
you may have
go camping,
through, right?
Right, driven through. But it's like, what, you know, there's more to this story.
Mm-hmm.
And so this project has allowed me and my colleagues to really kind of dip into those, you know, it's like, why is it that way? And why, how did this come to be? And, mm-hmm. And again, so much of the work that we do now is contemporary, looking at certain issues
today and looking forward. What's
right,
the impact
right.
of what happened today? Right.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much more to talk about with regard to North Star Journey, and we are going to continue the conversation about what makes these stories so unique and so important. But first, I have to say goodbye to Sarah Glover because she's got to go manage the newsroom. Sarah Glover, NPR News Managing Editor, also talking with Brant Williams, who's an editor of the Race, Class, and Communities team. Sarah, thank you for your time, and we look forward to hearing more updates updates about North Star Journey and its impact and what's next.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Right now, I just got to talk more about this North Star Journey. I spent a big portion of my evening yesterday, Brent, getting caught up on the stories. They're all collected in one area on our website. It's one way you can see them all. This new reporting project at NPR News. Brent Williams is the editor of our Race, Class, and Communities team here at NPR News, but also contributing reports and leading the coverage in this North Star Journey. Describe this Race, Class, and Communities teams. Let's take a step back here, Brent.
Sure.
Because some people may be wondering, well, what's different than what you're already doing, right, with North Star Journey?
And oh, for sure.
So what do you do in your role now leading this team of reporters?
Well, I'll just tell you a little bit about the team. I've got four reporters right now. Elizabeth Shockman, who is our K-12 education reporter. She covers the state of Minnesota.
She's been busy.
And she's been very busy. There's been a lot of education stories, particularly over these last couple of years. Nina Moyney, she's the latest addition to the team, and one of her main focus is immigration issues. Of course, Nina also covers city issues as well. Vicky Adame is our Report for America reporter, and she's been focusing on Latino communities throughout the state. We also have John Collins, and who has been focusing on Minneapolis city politics, policing, criminal justice issues. You probably heard John a lot over the last several months with the trials going on with Derek Chauvin, with Kimberly
Potter.
Thank you, Kimberly Potter. So many I can't keep up with, and he's going to be busy again this summer when the other three officers involved in the killing of George Floyd will be on a state trial. Of course, John also covered their federal trial as well. So that's the team that I'm working with, and it's been great working with them because they're all very smart people. They're all very hard workers, so they keep me very, very busy.
But as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the work that that team is doing is looking at what's happening now and providing some context and analysis for it and looking at the impact of it. North Star Journey, these reports are different in that we're looking back at the history of, like, why are things the way they are today? What happened, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago that led to this moment?
Right. And so that's why my team has been kind of taking a lead somewhat on the project and have had lots of story ideas themselves because so much of the work they do is already steeped in the history of Minnesota culture and history and of different people. And so, like, take for instance John Collins, who himself is a history major and has a deep interest in what's been going on in the state of Minnesota when it comes to farmers. For folks who don't know, or folks who don't follow John on social media, he often posts a lot of pictures of his garden and of the things he grows.
And brings in some of his
I'm looking forward to that.
Sometimes he shares.
This summer, exactly, his own CSA. But John has been focusing, he just produced a story on the history of some black farmers in Minnesota, the struggles that they've had to go to, and just getting their voices and their experiences on the air. And as I was reading through and we're talking about the story, I realized that we haven't had a lot of rural African Americans on our air talking about their experiences, not just farming, but just living in these smaller communities. So there was a lot of power in that. And of course, he included the historical information about discrimination by the USDA against black farmers around the country, not just in Minnesota. So that was just one area where John was able to bring together some of his personal interests, his background in history, background of knowledge of Minnesota history and history in general, and put that into a really informative story.
So then you have an understanding of why there are so few black farmers in Minnesota today.
Right.
Brent, I want to mention that in addition to editing, you're still reporting. In fact, you sort of kicked off North Star Journey with one of the initial pieces, and we're going to listen to an excerpt of that piece. Actually, it did. It was the first piece, right?
That's right.
And it's about place names in Minnesota. So before we listen to a little of it, how did you come up with this idea for the story, for that story?
Well, you know, Angela, it just seemed like the best way to start a series about Minnesota was just to start with the name of the state and the focus on the people whose language is used to describe the land here. So many, of course, place names and names of natural resources, lakes, rivers, and were created by the original people who were here long before white settlers came. And, of course, many of these names come from the Dakota and Ojibwe people. And so I figured that was a good place to start because there are – that's how people know us. We're Minnesota, but what's behind – yes. I know, in the beginning,
true,
there's
in
Minnesota.
The beginning.
And before Minnesota was Minnesota, there were people who were responsible for keeping up the land.
So you interviewed a woman named Kate Bean for this report. Tell us about Kate.
Right. So Kate was a great person to speak with. She's Dakota. She's a descendant, of course, of people who were actually physically forcibly removed from Minnesota by the U.S. soldiers. Her people were moved to the Flandreau Santee Reservation in South Dakota. And she has a, you know, she's a PhD in American Studies. She's the director of the Minnesota Museum of American Art.
So the word Minnesota itself is a Dakota phrase. So let's take a moment to listen to Kate Bean talk about that.
The way that I was taught is that Minnesota is a reflection of the sky on the water. And it's sort of that reflection, which is why oftentimes it gets translated as cloudy water, clear water. It depends on the weather.
Bean says European fur trappers and explorers would often ask residents what a lake or river was called, but she's not sure if some titles are names, directions to a place, or descriptions of food found there. But as Europeans settled, they often changed those names. Bean says that's just part of the larger process of erasing native culture, and that's reflected in how many Dakota names are mispronounced. Here are a few examples. Chaska.
Chaske.
Winona.
Winuna.
Wayzata.
The proper pronunciation is Wayzata.
Bean says these names were anglicized so English speakers could pronounce them easier.
But they're actually harder for us to pronounce as Dakota people because they're mispronunciation.
One of the reasons I love working in radio is that we get to use the human voice, audio,
right,
to tell stories. So Kate, my understanding, I've interviewed her before. She's been really busy in the last few years working on a lot of projects.
That's right. And of course, she was one of the people who is deeply involved in reclaiming the name Bede Makaska from Lake Calhoun. And that was something that she talked about a lot during our interview and why it was really important for that to be acknowledged for this lake that was named after someone who was a slave owner and not a friend of Native peoples at all. Had no real connection to Minnesota other than I think he was helped for created Fort Snelling. So it was important for folks to just say, you know what, this is not the appropriate name. The appropriate name is actually what the Dakota have been calling it for hundreds of years. And so she was a part of that, and it was important for folks to do that.
And now we're seeing many other examples of other places across Minnesota, places and institutions getting their names changed. And,
right.
You know, North Star Journey really gives an opportunity to look back as to, you know, why, like, but why? And, you know, I'm thinking about a lot of the schools that we're seeing right now.
Yeah. I mean, there's, and Ramsey's, you know, Alexander Ramsey School was changed to Justice Allen Page. Sibley High School was changed to Rivers High School. I spoke with the head of one of the departments at the Minnesota Historical Society, and he said, you know, this is actually also part of a larger movement in the United States going on where, as you've seen in other states, that there are people who are saying we need to acknowledge that some of the symbols and names that are used for places are very hurtful because they are named for people who supported the destruction of Native people and the destruction of African Americans and of the destruction of our Union, as in the, you know, example of these Confederate monuments in other states.
And some of the even more recent, too, you talked in that report to a sociologist named Rose Brewer about George Floyd Square. And what did she share about that?
Well, so I wanted to talk to Rose Brewer about George Floyd Square because the name George Floyd has become synonymous with so many different things. And of course, when people hear that name, they know that the story behind it. George Floyd was an African-American man killed by a Minneapolis police officer who knelt on his neck for more than 9 minutes. And basically George Floyd died on the spot. And so not only was it important for people to keep his name alive, and which is something that we see a lot as, you know, people who are killed by police officers. Their names are used to as a way to let people know, let's not forget, this is something that, that needs to change and we don't want to see this happen anymore. But people went a step further and they created George Floyd Square. And so this is a living monument, so to speak, to George mm-hmm. Floyd. And so I asked Rose about why she felt like that was different or why it was important for that to happen.
We're talking about a North Star Journey, an ambitious reporting project here at NPR News that focuses on the history and the culture of Minnesota's diverse communities. Talking with Brant Williams, who is a news editor here at NPR and a longtime reporter before he moved into his editing role. And so, Brant, we're trying to make sure people are getting a chance to listen to and read these stories that are part of this North Star Journey. And some of these, you know, we've mentioned some of them really reveal some surprising stories about the history of Minnesota and about our culture. And so I mentioned in the introduction a piece about Edina, this interracial community in Edina. Tell us more about that story and where that information came from.
Right. So that came from a historian and an author named Chad Montree. I interviewed him a little while back about his book, which was just released last month. It's called Whiteness in Plain View: A History of Racial Exclusion in Minnesota. And the book talks about this community as being well integrated, part of a movement of more of an agricultural type of society that was somewhat more egalitarian and somewhat progressive. But he said over the years, white residents began to leave this community in Edina, and black people were prevented from buying homes there. Of course, we've heard about racial covenants and that sort of thing. And that was one of the reasons why there was this segregation there that grew in Edina. And he mentions, he actually put a picture in the book that shows a production that was performed at a Edina high school in the 1950s. And there are dozens of people on stage and they're all in blackface. And he told me that that was an instance where just seeing this picture kind of helped him make that connection between there was an actual physical manifestation of the type of discrimination that was shown through in that photo, that there are people there who dressed up in blackface and performed these productions. And this was not a one-time thing. It sounded like this was a regular occurrence, not only in Edina, but other communities around Minnesota.
And that report gets into also just the history of the state, what we've seen with redlining. Black people were prevented from buying homes there, and that has contributed to the segregation in the city that we have seen even today, right, for decades to come.
Right.
Another history piece about a neighborhood here in the Twin Cities came from reporter Vicky Adame, and she talks about Westside Flats in St. Paul. Can you tell us more about that?
Right. So Westside Flats was a community that was made up of, a variety of immigrant communities, and over by Westside of St. Paul, near the river, that community also included a significant population of Latinos. And so Vicky, in doing her research, she found some older gentlemen who grew up in the area, and she was able to meet up with them one day at a restaurant where these gentlemen meet regularly, and they sit down and they chat and they talk about the old neighborhood and whatever else. And one of the men she talked to was a man named Augie Garcia. Now, she makes it clear in the story that this is not the famous Augie Garcia, who was a bit of a Minnesota musical legend, and she addressed that in the story.
All right, we're going to listen to an excerpt of that piece by reporter Vicky Adame about West Side Flats.
Agustin Augie Garcia was born in the West Side in 1946. He lived in the West Side Flats until his family moved in 1959.
The West Side was a melting pot as far as Adam's concerned.
He is one of several gentlemen who meet Tuesday mornings at the Sunlight Restaurant in South St. Paul to talk and reminisce. Garcia is quick to point out he's not that Augie Garcia. The other Augie Garcia, also from the Westside Flats, is the man who came to be known as the godfather of Minnesota rock and roll. Augie Garcia died in 1999, but he is perhaps best remembered for nearly upstaging Elvis. In 1956, Elvis performed at the St. Paul Auditorium, and the Augie Garcia Quintet was the opening act. News reports recount that Garcia whipped the crowd into such a frenzy Elvis's manager had him pulled off the stage.
Yes, that's Ivy League Baby, sung by Augie Garcia. What a fun piece of history to learn about. But there's also, you know, a real sad side to the story about that community's history, Brent.
Right, right. Of course, this was a neighborhood that, like others, was basically torn down. Westside Flats was located in a floodplain near the river, and it would flood constantly. And the city decided to tear down the homes. People were paid for their property, although one of the men in the story said they were not fair in how they decided what to how to compensate people. But these folks were moved away, and later the city built a flood wall and then turned the area into an industrial park.
There's a lot there.
Yes.
And then, you know, also, you know, there's a website component to North Star Journey. So there are historical photos. We should mention that with a lot of to accompany the audio version of these stories. You can get a lot of photos of some of, I guess, provided by historians or families right. in some of these reports. Because I looked at these pictures last night.
Yeah. And it's really a nice way to be able to, again, you can go down. I've gone down rabbit holes where I've gone to like historical society's website and other historical sources and found these photos, just seeing how the people lived and where they lived and how they were dressed and what these neighborhoods look like, especially if you're familiar with a part of town, mm-hmm. but you didn't see what it looked like 70 years ago. So that's a nice resource to have.
You know, I think about these photos. I always say I'm very visual. I need pictures and video to help me understand things. But, you know, one of the early descriptions of the North Star Journey Project is that, you know, one of the goals is to elevate understanding and empathy. So we're trying to elevate understanding and empathy. Brent, what does that mean to you? Why is empathy so important?
Right. I think it's important in any journalism, but especially in this project, that people have access to see the different experiences that people have here. It's, you know, not everyone in Minnesota sees the events of the day in the same way.
Yes.
And I think it's important to highlight some of the stories and tell them in a way that expresses people's full humanity and experience. And so we included stories that talk about some tough subjects, and we couldn't have a project like this without addressing some of the elephant in the room, the racism, the discrimination, though we did not want to dwell on that. And so we really wanted to find that balance of making these experiences known and tell the full story, and that includes some of the good, some of the bad.
Right. I mean, it's our history. It's our truth. It is how we came to be. One story I think that really builds on that sense of empathy is a report that Dan Gunderson did, who's in our Moorhead Bureau, a piece about the high rate of incarceration among Native women. Tell us a little bit about what that piece is about, and then we're going to listen to some of it.
Right, yeah. And this is a great story to focus on. And as you find out in the story, Native women make up a very small percentage of the state's population, but are very overrepresented in the state's prison system. And so Dan looked at some of the causes for this, and he also looked at how members of Native communities are working to mend the lives of women and their families that have been so directly affected by what's going on.
All right, let's listen to some of this report by Dan Gunderson for North Star Journey.
Many Native people share a sense that the criminal justice system is stacked against them and that no one hears them when they ask for help.
You know, you have all the barriers. You don't have no money. You don't have nothing. You just get out. You got to figure it out.
Natasha Kingbird has been in that place where hope is elusive, and she's using the experience to provide support for Native women trying to overcome the sense that no one cares. She recalls having a nice life until age 10 when her great-grandmother died and her parents split up.
I was a young girl trying to figure out what I wanted, but not having that guidance and feeling like nobody cared.
She spent time in foster care, and later she survived domestic abuse and time incarcerated as a juvenile and an adult. Understanding the experience of feeling helpless and unseen powers Kingbird's work with incarcerated women who come to the Northwest Indian Community Development Center for support and help navigating the system.
I dedicated a lot of time here to help women to be looked at as equal and not as, oh, they're just a criminal. They're just, you know, like, they ain't gonna amount to nothing, you know.
Reconnecting with her Anishinaabe culture gave Kingbird a new identity, focus, and strength. She has become a leading advocate for a unique project designed to help other Native women find their footing. It's called the Healing House. The idea is to use culture and traditional ceremonies to help women heal from trauma, putting them on a healthy path back into the community.
That's an excerpt of a piece by reporter Dan Gunderson as part of our North Star Journey series, an ambitious new reporting project here at NPR News that really dives into the history and the culture of Minnesota. Some great storytelling available. And Brant, just want to remind people, if we've really gotten them interested and we want to hear about more of the stories, where they can find them all, because we've tried to make it easy to find them and listen to them and read about them.
Right. They are available on our website, nprnews.org, and just click on the North Star Journey tab, and you can find the audio versions and written, which are also very fascinating, these versions. But they're also available in podcast form. We do put them out as a collection where you get podcasts. You can just go, and you will find every week there will be you'll be able to listen to these.
I've voiced some of the intros and transitions for these pieces, and yes, you can find them in podcast form as well. All right, and this project, new reports will continue through the middle of the summer.
That's right, into July, as a matter of fact.
North Star Journey, check it out. It's part of what makes NPR News unique, fabulous, and worth your support. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder that if you want to catch my show in real time, tune in and call in weekdays at 9 a.m.